This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a year-long San Luis Obispo Tribune investigation into substandard housing.
If cities choose not to enforce state housing codes, then the slumlord can continue to rent poor housing to people and tenants continue to suffer. So it's kind of an ugly cycle.
And we'll hear from San Luis Obispo County's newest supervisor.
I was reading The Diary of Anne Frank, and I was watching the Vietnam War on TV as a fourth grader. And it impacted me. It really impacted me.
Those stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, December 14th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Lindsay Holden is a reporter for the San Luis Obispo Tribune. She, with reporting assistance from her colleague Cassandra Gary Bai, recently published a series about a year-long investigation into substandard housing in San Luis Obispo County. It was a project for a fellowship Holden completed at the USC Center for Health Journalism, and it started with the Grandview Apartments story in Paso Robles. That was an apartment complex where, for years, dozens of households lived in appalling conditions. KCBX's Greta Mart spoke with Holden and Gary Bai about what came to light via the investigative project.
What triggered this investigation? Where did it start? What'd you find? And we'll go from there.
I started working on this project about a year ago. So basically, there were hundreds of tenants living in this apartment complex in Paso Robles. It's on Spring Street when you get off the freeway there, and they had been living there with pretty bad conditions, everything from bed bugs, plumbing problems, cockroaches, roof leaks, a lot of problems for years. And they decided to file a class action lawsuit against their landlords. So we spent time at the complex talking to residents, and kind of made me think that, you know, this must be just the tip of the iceberg, that there must be a lot of residents living with conditions like this around San Luis Obispo County. And the residents at the complex primarily spoke Spanish and worked in the agriculture and tourism industries. And so that's kind of where I focused my project, which I did with help from a grant from the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. And so we conducted surveying around the county in different communities in Oceano, San Miguel, Paso Robles, Grover Beach, and tried to talk to residents about their experiences with substandard rental housing. And yeah, then we produced some stories and I learned a lot about what's going on in the county with rental housing.
For people that don't know, take us through what's currently happening at the Grandview. What happened since the class action suit?
So that suit was filed in May 2019. And since that time, a bunch of things happened. The tenants didn't have to pay rent for some time because a judge found, the lawyers were able to prove that the conditions were so bad that the tenants shouldn't have to pay rent. But then the apartment owners found that they would have to make millions of dollars in repairs, and they decided to close the complex instead of doing that. And so all of those tenants were displaced and had to find new places to live. Now the complex was sold and a new owner is fixing it up to rent again.
The Codo Group, they're a Santa Barbara-based boutique apartment complex owners, and so they bought the Grandview complex and are remodeling it and getting ready to start renting that out.
But I take it it's high-end stuff, so none of these former renters are ever going to be able to afford this place, correct?
They said that the price range won't be too far off. However, what we found was a lot of people had to, in the time between, you know, when the apartment complex would be ready again, they needed to find new places. Some people had to move out of the area. It was just too big of a time gap for some people to wait.
Give us just a brief window into exactly what you do to conduct this kind of reporting. Where did you start in terms of, did you start with documents?
We worked very closely with the Promotores Collaborative of San Luis Obispo County. They're a group that's part of the Center for Family Strengthening, and they work with the Latino community in San Luis Obispo County. And they helped us identify areas to canvas, and they canvassed alongside us to talk to residents, because I think that was the first thing we needed to do to understand their experience. And they were an invaluable partner in this project. So I think that was super important. And I don't know if Cassandra, you were part of our canvassing. So if you'd like to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So one of the first things we did was, after speaking to the Grandview residents, we identified some apartment complexes throughout the county and areas in San Miguel where we thought renters were living. And so we went door to door with the survey and just kind of asked people questions in both English and Spanish. And then we scanned all those surveys, and then Lindsay started looking at the data and seeing what were some of the most common reoccurrences, and, you know, how many people were reporting to landlords and how many people said that they feared eviction or retaliation if they did report issues. So it really started with talking to people and then went into looking at data.
When you knocked on these people's doors, what was the reaction? Were people suspicious of you? Were people just, once they found out what you were actually doing, were they more forthcoming? Or tell me the response.
Some people, I think, were suspicious. But once we had kind of explained what we were doing, that it was a project for the Tribune and that their information wouldn't be used unless we followed up with them and made sure that was okay, they were more willing to talk. But in some areas, we saw visible broken windows or exposed wires, and we would ask them if they have any problems, and they said no. A lot of people were kind of fearful. Some people we couldn't win over, and we, you know, made a note that we can see broken windows, we can see this, but they didn't say that there were any problems. And other people, the promotores really helped build that trust. Many of them knew people and were very involved in the community. And so I think that partnership really allowed people to trust us a little more.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to an interview with San Luis Obispo Tribune reporters Lindsay Holden and Cassandra Gary Bai, speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart about the Tribune's recent investigative series into substandard housing in San Luis Obispo County.
I think this is a tough topic to try and talk to people about, because, you know, when they're talking about their rental housing experiences, they're talking about their home and where they live. And if there's any kind of concern about losing that, I think that inspires a lot of fear, completely understandably.
Okay, let's take up the story once you started hitting the documents. Where exactly did you start looking?
Another part of my project involved looking at code enforcement, substandard housing code enforcement complaints. So anyone living in this county's seven cities or in the county, if they have, they're experiencing substandard housing conditions, they can report those to their city or to the county, and the county can send an inspector to look at them and to, you know, assess whether the owner of the property is violating state housing codes. So I looked at those complaints and kind of found that a lot of people aren't complaining based on the number of people that we talked to who said they had issues with their housing and the number of people who complained. There's clearly a gap between what's really happening and how many people are complaining. And I also found a lot of cities don't have enough code enforcement staff. They only have like one person or a part-time person, which kind of indicates that the city doesn't devote a lot of resources to code enforcement, which can present a problem in terms of outreach. Tenants probably don't know they can reach out to code enforcement for help in terms of getting problems taken care of in a quick manner. And in Paso Robles, that was a huge problem with Grandview. The tenants complained before filing the lawsuit. The city did inspect, but they didn't cite the owners of the complex until after the lawsuit had been filed. And
why not?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I talked to city officials and they were aware, they're open about the fact that the owners were kind of putting band-aids on problems and not fixing them. For instance, you know, taking care of a bed bug problem in one apartment isn't going to take care of the problem in the whole complex. And there were just a lot of bigger problems that would require a lot more resources to fix. But I honestly am not sure. I mean, that really contributed to a lot of tenant suffering. They lived with problems because the city didn't do anything. And the city hasn't done anything substantially to fix their code enforcement system. Hopefully identifying this problem can help tenants in the future.
On a personal level, just after reporting this story, where do you feel, I don't know if I want to say blame, or who needs to step up? Is it the city or is it the slumlords?
I think it's both. I think it's kind of part of a system. You know, if cities choose not to enforce state housing codes, then slumlords can continue to rent poor housing to people and tenants continue to suffer. So it's kind of an ugly cycle. If cities enforced housing codes, then of course that's not going to solve the problem completely, but it would make things better for tenants. If they conducted additional tenant outreach to tell them about their resources, that would also help. So I think it's twofold. I mean, you can't expect landlords to comply with rules if cities aren't taking them seriously.
That's right. That makes a lot of sense. Okay. And so you looked at this in Paso Robles, but did you find this all over San Luis Obispo County?
Yes. I mean, the city of San Luis Obispo probably has the most aggressive code enforcement in the county. They have 4 staffers. They, you know, have a system where they fine landlords, property owners who aren't complying with state housing codes. But code enforcement officers there told me that they still have tenants who don't complain about problems because they're worried about being retaliated against by their landlords. And, you know, that's illegal. Landlords can't retaliate against tenants who report problems to code enforcement, but a lot of tenants don't know that and don't want to have to deal with potentially going to court against their landlord. So even in cities where they have more robust code enforcement, that's still a problem.
To add to that, kind of what Lindsay said, a lot of tenants that we spoke to, I don't think they knew the process of code enforcement. I don't think they knew that they could go above their landlord, for instance, to report problems that weren't being dealt with. I know for sure until I helped with this project that I didn't know what my rights were as a renter, and I think that a lot of people didn't either.
Absolutely. Excellent point. Okay, and so did you find that things were different in different cities? Like, for instance, does Morro Bay spend more money on code enforcement, you know, salaries so that they have better code enforcement? Or did you find it was pretty much the same, no matter if it was in the county or if it was under a particular city jurisdiction?
I think that's one of the problems with the code enforcement in the county. It's very inconsistent. Different cities spend different amounts of money on code enforcement, devote different levels of staffing to code enforcement, and I think different levels of outreach to tenants. And so, I mean, even like the county, so San Luis Obispo, the city has the most code enforcement of any city in the county. The county has the most, I mean, with the most miles of roads to travel and such, has the highest level of code enforcement staffing, but they had very few complaints compared to San Luis Obispo, the city. So no, I mean, depending on where you live in San Luis Obispo County, you could have a completely different experience with code enforcement, which that's not right.
Is there one particular resource that renters can turn to get this kind of information if they want to figure out what their rights are?
Yes. So we are sharing on our website, we have, in English and Spanish, we have tenants' rights guides for renters to help them understand their rights, to provide some resources for them if they would like to, you know, contact a legal aid attorney or, you know, reach out to the promotores or, you know, other people who could help them. So yeah, they can find those resources on our website. And we also have PDF copies and photocopies of those guides that we made in English and Spanish. So we can share those with you.
Okay, got it. And okay, so let's go back. You looked at the documents, you wrote this story. What's next in this investigation?
So my next story, which will come out Tuesday, will look at potential solutions for renters, how the situation can be improved here. And specifically, I'll be looking at rental inspection programs, which the city of San Luis Obispo had a program for about 18 months before it was repealed in 2017. And I just wanted to look at the failures of that program, because when you look at how conditions can be improved, rental inspections are one of the best practices for improving tenant experiences. And then also looking at how tenants can potentially organize, which that's a crucial part of improving their experiences, kind of coming together and demanding better experiences, which I've seen in some of the other cities that I've looked at.
It was the landlords, right, that really put, there was huge pushback from landlords saying, we don't want you coming and inspecting us. Is that what happened?
Well, that's what I'm looking at as we speak. But yeah, it was kind of a combination of landlords and tenants and, you know, being concerned about what this program would mean for them. You know, can I refuse to have the inspection? All of these concerns. And yeah, I'll be looking at all of those things in my next story, because I think it's important to understand what happened there so we can move forward and help tenants in the future.
Absolutely. And of course, there's so much momentum right now with the eviction, COVID-related evictions. How do you see this tying in? Is it two separate issues?
No, I think they're connected very much so. I mean, tenants who aren't aware of their rights may not be aware that their landlords, evictions are ongoing right now, but if they're not aware of their rights and they don't know how to protect themselves, then they could be illegally evicted. They could be living in poor housing conditions. Right now, I mean, people are at home more than ever. They're dealing with these problems more than ever. And so, yeah, no, they're all entirely connected. Tenants need to know their rights and need to know how to empower themselves.
That was SLO Tribune reporters Lindsay Holden and Cassandra Garibay speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart about their recent investigative series into the substandard housing in San Luis Obispo County. Hear the full-length interview and find links to the series at kcbx.org. Next, we'll hear from newly seated San Luis Obispo County 3rd District Supervisor Don Ortiz Legg in a conversation with Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. Governor Gavin Newsom appointed Ortiz Legg to replace the late Adam Hill. She officially stepped into the role as a voting member of the board last Tuesday.
Thank you so much for being here, Madam Supervisor. Glad to have you.
Good afternoon, Jim. Nice to be here.
They swore you in. This one completes Supervisor Hill's current term, right? And does that mean they'll have to swear you in again in January for the new term?
Yes, I will be sworn in on January 4th with the other two board members who won their seats in the primary in March. Adam would have been sworn in at this time too. Unfortunately, you know, this has been a bittersweet appointment in the sense of losing him and his leadership, which, you know, the last few years have been a little bit rough. And you know, a mental health conversation probably would be in fashion for this if we had more time or we should schedule something like this, because it's something that I'm really learning about as well. I had never had this kind of situation in my life where I had been speaking with somebody and hoping that things were going well and then they didn't. But at any rate, I'll be sworn in January, and then I will have a 2-year appointment, and then the seat will be open for candidate seat to run in 2022.
So you get the great part about being there for 2 years and then having to run immediately right after, huh?
I really am looking at this a little bit differently. I mean, first off, I didn't have to have a campaign, so I didn't have to expend the energy and do all that. And second is that we got a real job here. We got a lot of things coming at us in the district as well as the county. You know, it's not just the COVID, it's the closure of Diablo Canyon. It's, you know, trying to get people back on track after COVID with the education. We've got Cal Poly numbers to think about. We've got budgets to think about. Campaign, yes, because I've been through a campaign, a rigorous campaign once in my life, which I lost, that I think that really I have the opportunity to just go to work on this job. And that's really going to be my campaign. What can I deliver? How can I be there for the citizens? If I do a good job, I think that if I put my name on the ballot, then things will work out. And you know, that's my strategy at this point.
You had your first day on the board on Tuesday. How was your first day? You had some big items on your plate, right?
It's exhilarating for the honor. It's also extremely serious right now. I mean, not that this would ever be a light and easy job to begin with, but there's no doubt that we've never had any kind of environment like we have right now for 100 years to have a global pandemic that's really just devastating so many individuals and economies and public sectors. So the day was long. We heard for the first 2 hours, callers calling in regards to our mapping in the Los Angeles region and why we had to shut down. And, you know, I don't think I need to go on any further about the frustration that people feel, but the desperation that was so clear on many of the calls from business owners concerned about their employees who can't pay the rent and have, you know, Christmas barreling down with kids at home and just the stress that it's been for this long. And yet we have to forge through these times to get to the end of this really dark winter, which we don't even know the true outcome yet.
It was less than a month ago you got the call that you're in and the speed that this is all happening. Do you have any staff yet or are you the Lone Ranger?
Actually, Susan Devine is my interim legislative assistant. She was Adam Hill's legislative assistant. Many people may know Susan from 2008 to 2012. And I have to say, county staff, wow, really been wonderful. And my fellow board members, you know, they've been very welcoming. Everybody has been more than happy to help me out in any way possible.
Did you have much interaction with your colleagues prior to your appointment, or are this the first time everyone's getting to know each other?
Well, Debbie, I've known for years because of the Topaz Solar Farm is in the Carrizo Plains. And at the time when we were developing it, she was the legislative assistant of Senator Sam Blakesley, then Senator Sam Blakesley. And so had a lot of interaction with her. John, I got to meet in Chandon, of all things, because we developed a solar farm out there. And so I was at the Chandon Community District for a number of years, sitting in, listening to their issues while getting them prepared for the solar farm out that way. And then Lynn, I had time with at the EVC board. And so there was a number of initiatives that went forth. So I do have relationships. And of course, Bruce, I've known for a number of years as well. There's a lot of familiarity.
Taking it back a bit, how did you get first started in public service and what drew you to this arena? Was this were you a public service family or is this just something that you've taken on?
I know we only have a few minutes here, but really my awareness of politics, public service is, you know, I have a very distinct memory of fourth grade and I was reading The Diary of Anne Frank and I was watching the Vietnam War on TV as a fourth grader. And it impacted me. It really impacted me. And political science, current events, history, American history, world history were my best subjects. When I was a senior in high school, it was 1976 election with Gerald Ford. I watched every Watergate hearing too. I mean, I remember the conventions on TV. I, for some reason, I've always been glued to it. So I had a poster in my bedroom about, you know, the size of this closet of Gerald Ford. I love Gerald Ford, you know, and I'm a Democrat now, but I was a very big Republican and I grew up with Land of Lincoln, baby. So it's been a long time coming. But when I got to college, I told my career person that I wanted to be in. What do you think you're interested in? Political science. Well, this was 1977 after Watergate and the apathy in America was very high. And she's like, well, what are you going to do with that? Well, I was just a small Midwest girl. I had no idea. So I'm like, I don't know. Well, okay, I'll change it. And I think I went into advertising or something that I never was successful at. And so interestingly enough, as I told Governor Newsom on the phone, I feel like because I didn't just go into political science at the time, I actually did a number of things. It actually prepared me very well for this moment right now. So I had 20 years in international business. I worked in electronics field in international business. I always worked in agency interaction. So helping business navigate government, the regulatory field. So I've done that the majority of my career. I'm on the opposite side of that, but I think I bring a perspective of the frustration that business has in dealing with government regulations. And so, yeah, it all came together this year. And I will say that my father is a philanthropist, so to speak. I mean, he's not wealthy in that sense of the word, but he has a nonprofit called iCare International. And a lot of people here on the Central Coast have traveled with them to do our iCare missions, which I've been on since 1985. So public service, my father was very much in, got that. My parents, you know, always giving back to the communities, both locally, internationally, nationally, all of that. So I guess it's in my DNA.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Newly appointed San Luis Obispo County Supervisor Don Ortiz Legg is speaking with Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce.
So I know we're very early into your new appointment, but has there been a particular issue that constituents have already asked for you to tackle right off the bat, or that you were going in kind of with already?
Well, the one issue I think that is, besides the COVID, is the closure of Diablo Canyon. And this is really the impetus for me to leave my career and put my name in the hat for the appointment. I feel it's really critical to our community about what's happening in these next years and how we get to decide on what our future is going to be tied to that incredible asset out there. So we had a chance on Tuesday to vote for some funding on items that are going to be help us navigate this impact. Funding REACH, one of them. I had been kind of out of the loop for the last couple of years with my job. I spent a lot of time in Santa Cruz and Monterey counties for PG&E. But coming back in and looking at what's going on at REACH, I was just like, it was just perfect. It was wonderful. I was very happy to see the regionalism impact. I thought there's a lot of things that they're offering and the people that are involved, and I'm very excited to be behind that. So they're looking for economic championship. Adam was that champion for a long time. So that's really a driving force for me. Obviously, there's other issues. There's mental health issues. There are homeless issues. You know, the housing issues, all of these things, but it really goes back to me to the fundamental foundation of our economy and what has been and what it's going to be. Because we can do so much more when we have a robust and diverse economy, which is really the driving factor of again, why I chose to participate in becoming a supervisor, as well as what happened on Tuesday. We also funded the program that is going through Cuesta College for a mechanics of aviation it's aviation and unmanned aircraft and all of that kind of thing, which is going to be really terrific for high school students that are looking for something sexy to get involved in, so to speak, because it's, you know, it's all of the stuff with satellites and things, and it's a mechanic level, but it gives them an opportunity within 2 years to have a really good foundation for an income. And so starting at $50,000. So that was a good win. So there was some hard things on Tuesday, but there was a lot of good stuff too. And the other part, and I want to make this very clear, is that it was my experience building solar farms that got me to recognize the importance of our trade unions and organized labor when it comes to the crafts, electricians, plumbers, laborers, operating engineers, steel workers. These people are, again, very important for our economy. These are living wages. They have great skill opportunities, training opportunities. I've been through a graduating class of electricians that started out just as we say, you know, the local hands, and then they've moved up and done the apprenticeship programs, and they are now well-earning electricians that started out at the solar farm, and it's a really exciting part, and I'm also there for them, and that's very much tied into creating this industrial base that we're looking to do here, and it's doable, folks. It's doable.
That was newly appointed San Luis Obispo County Supervisor Don Ortiz Legg, speaking with Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. On today's nonprofit story, Consuelo Mukes is joined by Julie Rodewald, Voter Service Director for the San Luis Obispo County Chapter of League of Women Voters. She spent 20 years as the elected County Clerk Recorder and Registrar of Voters.
Tell us a little bit about the League of Women Voters.
Sure. We just celebrated the 100-year centennial anniversary of the formation of the League of Women Voters. That was in February, as well as the 100-year centennial for the 19th Amendment passing and women getting the right to vote.
That's right. Great.
So it was a big celebration year, obviously cut short of many of our celebrations by the pandemic. But the League is a nonpartisan organization, which means that we don't support or oppose political parties or candidates. It's a national organization, and then each state has a league, and then communities. In our county, it's the League of Women Voters of San Luis Obispo County. But in many counties, you'll have a league chapter for just a city, several cities in the county, and not just the county. So it's a very grassroots organization, and our mission is to defend democracy and encourage civic engagement, defend the right to vote, and then encourage people to participate, whether it's in voting or in discussion of issues. That's primarily where our focus has been in our local league. And we also have a civil discourse agenda that we adopted several years ago and have rolled out to all of the cities and the county, asking our elected officials to adopt the pledge to be more civil in their interactions with each other, as well as the public being civil, vice versa, between the elected officials. And that's been a really wonderful project for us to take on.
I think you do some training in that. Is that correct?
Yes. Those that are involved in the civil discourse also do kind of, I don't know if it's really mediation training, but training with elected bodies. You know, there are some of our government bodies that are made up of elected officials from different cities or different agencies. And so they've worked with them to help them better communicate and to help them better communicate their differences and resolve those differences if they can.
I know you did a lot of work as the league during this election season, which had been so important and so much going on. Tell us a little bit about how the league functions when there is an election.
So the beginning of the year, we had a March primary, early March primary. So the league was very involved with, we moderated several candidate forums. We also adopted three polling places. So our members would actually work as poll workers on election day, greeting the voters, helping the voters, being able to cast their ballots. And then we always ramp up our voter registration efforts. We do a year-long registration efforts with our high school students because students can pre-register at 16. They can't vote until they're 18, but when we go in and speak to the students in their classrooms, they all have the opportunity to register to vote or pre-register to vote. So that's been a really encouraging project. And then as we get closer to an election, of course, we're really ramping up. We want to make sure that we reach every student who might have the opportunity to vote in the upcoming election. Now, of course, that all changed about March 16th, about a week and a half after the election. And so there was kind of a lot of, so what is our role going to be? We can't go into the high schools. We can't have in-person voter registration, huge events where we're there to register voters. We can't have in-person candidate forums. You know, where does the league fit in and how do we operate under these new guidelines that we had? And just like everybody else, we really had to scramble to figure out what we were going to do and how we could be of assistance to our voters and encourage participation. We were able to moderate, I think, seven candidate forums via Zoom, which really worked out wonderfully. And I think we got better attendance because people didn't have to drive at night. They could sit at home and watch a candidate's forum. So I think that was really well received by the community, as well as the candidates, because they were in the same boat. That, you know, in-person campaigning is difficult. So it did give them the opportunity. One of the other things that we get involved in around an election is called Voters Edge, which is a website. It's sponsored by the League of Women Voters of California. And it gives every candidate the opportunity to kind of tell their story, you know, who they are, what their background is, what their positions are. And it all has to come from, this is me, not don't vote for my opponent, but this is why you should vote for me. So it comes from a very positive place. And the other thing that it does is for the state ballot measures and the state candidates, it shows where they're getting their money. who their top donors are, how much money they've gotten from those top donors. So it really allows people to kind of delve into what's behind this ballot proposition or who's supporting this candidate. Those are for the state. That's not true of the local level. But I think that that was a very well received. We're still waiting for statistics as to how many hits we got in our county. But I think that that was very well received. And we had about a 70% participation rate from our candidates.
Probably a good increase. So much good work in helping to make transparency with the voting process within our county, right, which has been so important. I think the high school program that you're doing is just fabulous, you know, to get the young people involved. Are you also helping them to understand about the responsibility? Well, I think the responsibilities of voting, but also getting to the polls and doing their first submission of their ballot. That has to be very exciting.
Right. It is. It's really one of the really rewarding things that we do, especially when we're there in an election year and you get the realization that these kids are going to be able to vote for their very first time. And it takes us back. I mean, one of the stories I tell them is, you know, we think about voting rights, but it was only, you know, 64, 65, 71 was when 18-year-olds got the right to vote. All those happened in my lifetime.
Right.
And I think that, you know, when you say that to them, it's like, wow, I didn't think about that. And I was 18 the first year that 18-year-old could vote for president. And you just remember the electricity that was going on about being able to vote, and to see that light in their eyes too, it's just really encouraging. And we certainly hope, I mean, obviously a presidential election brings out many more voters than others, but we certainly hope that that carries forward. And one of the things that we say is that if you vote in your first three of your first four elections, you're more likely to be a lifetime voter. And if you don't, then you're more likely to be a lifetime non-voter, that you only show up occasionally. So we really try and encourage them to make a lifelong habit of voting and being involved in elections, at least at that level.
That's such an important thing for a citizen. And the fact that we can get out there and vote is a privilege that we just really don't ever want to take for granted.
This is KCBX, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. Julie Rodewald of the League of Women Voters is speaking with KCBX contributor Consuelo Mukes.
How was it this particular one, this particular election, which has turned out to be quite interesting in history? Did we find an increase in voters in our county, or did you find a lot of shifts or changes that happened with this particular presidential election?
You know, there was a huge increase, almost 30,000 more voters than we've ever had registered.
Wow.
And we had the highest percentage voter turnout. We had, it was a little over 88%, and the highest we've ever had in a presidential election, which is always our biggest, is a little over 83%. So we not only beat the registration numbers, obviously the number of people who voted, but the percentage was just, I was hoping we'd get 90, but we fell just a little bit short. Yeah, you know, I think what's going to be really interesting is when we see, because there's a report that would break it down by age group, and the 18 to 19, about 18, maybe up to 25, maybe 30 was about 75% turnout. As you get into the older ages, it gets closer to 90, over 90%. So the youth are still voting in a lower percentage. But what's going to be really interesting is after the census numbers come out and we can see what percentage of the eligible population registered to vote. Because that's really the critical thing, is because that's about what the percentage is typically from that age group, is about 75%. But in the past, only 40% of the eligibles were registered to vote. If now we're looking at 60 or 70% of the eligibles that are registered to vote, that's a huge increase. But we won't know that until we see some numbers about, you know, how many eligible voters there were.
Right. So what do you feel are some of the major issues that helped to bring people out? And did you find that a lot of them actually went to the polls, or did they take advantage of the early voting through mail?
Vast majority took advantage of the early voting through mail. Obviously, everybody got every registered voter. I always have to clarify that every registered voter was sent a vote by mail ballot in an effort to encourage people to use that ballot. Some people didn't want to. They still wanted to go to the polls. I think that the final numbers were somewhere between 8 and 9,000 went to the polls, and then the rest did their vote by mail ballot. Now, they might have gone to the polls and turned in their vote by mail ballot, but they didn't actually cast a ballot at the polling place. Obviously, having the 4 days of voting was a big change for our county. You know, typically it's Tuesday, right, 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. That's it. That's your opportunity if you didn't vote by mail. But now with those 4 days of voting, it really helps spread the crowds out over those 4 days, which was very helpful because, you know, we tried to maintain social distancing and cleaning equipment and everything else that went along with voting in the time of COVID, if you will. Yeah, I think that people really appreciated the opportunity to be able to go to a poll and cast their ballot, but they also appreciated the opportunity of not having to go to the polls to cast their ballot.
Right. It just seemed to give more opportunity to more people to get that vote in this very important year. And I had a chance, and I always do after the elections, I go online and I see what we did in our county and who voted and where. And it just seemed like it was a very streamlined process. It always does seem that way, where some counties had a lot of disruption or issues. What did you find happened with the vote?
You know, it really, I mean, the 4 days of voting, I was actually working for the county clerk. And so I was in the office or the command center, as they called it, for Monday and Tuesday. Everything just went really, really smoothly. We had very few disruptions at the polls. I mean, you know, you're going to have an occasional voter gets upset about something or thinks that they're going to be denied the right to vote or whatever it is. But very, very few of those. The poll workers, I can't say enough about the people that volunteered to work during those 4 days. I mean, it was, I've talked to a few of them afterwards and they said it was grueling. I mean, some of them worked all 4 days.
Where do the volunteer poll workers come from?
You know, they kind of come from all over. For this election and for many elections, there's a what's called an Adopt-a-Poll program, which I mentioned before that the league has done in the past. We didn't this election. So community groups can say, we'll supply you all the staff. But if anybody's interested in working at the polls, they really just need to sign up through the county clerk's website, get an application on file to be a poll worker. 900 to 1,000 people working at the polls. Now with this election, because we had fewer polling places, even though they were open for the 4 days, it was closer to about 400. But still, that's a lot of people to recruit and to get trained. But I really, you know, obviously, when I was a county clerk, I couldn't go and work at the polls on election day. I had other things to do. Right. But since I've been with the league, I've worked, I think, the last three elections. And it's just such a rewarding experience to be able to be there. The voters are so appreciative of what the poll workers do. It's exciting to see first-time voters walk in. You know, their moms are taking pictures of them as they sign the roster, as they get their ballot. You know, it just really makes you have faith in our democracy. And you see all the safeguards that are in place to ensure that every eligible voter is able to vote. And if there's any question, that ballot can be set aside in a provisional envelope and it can be adjudicated, if you will, after the fact. But everybody has the opportunity to cast a ballot on election day.
Julie, as we wrap up here, tell people how they could get involved with the league if they would be interested in doing so.
Sure, we'd love to have new members. So the one thing that's nice about the league is that you can be as involved as you want to be. Obviously, we want people that want to join the league and want to be involved, but we also understand that if somebody's working, they don't have as much time to give, or maybe they're caring for small children or an elderly parent. So you can be as involved as you'd like to be. But our website is lwvslo.org.
Thank you so much, Julie. This has been Julie Rodewald. She is the Voter Services Chair of the League of Women Voters, and this is The Nonprofit Story.
And finally, the Santa Barbara Zoo announced the November birth of an African lion cub. Pauline required some extra medical care, but is now doing well. Contributor Beth Thornton talked with the zoo's Dr. Julie Barnes to get an update on the cub and also to find out how the zoo is managing during these challenging times.
The last time we spoke was the beginning of the pandemic when Tweeka the giraffe was born. And today, during another closure, we're talking about the birth of a lion cub. So before we get to the latest news, can you give us a quick update on Tweeka?
Tweeka's doing really well. Very strong, healthy calf. He's almost the size of his mother now. He's got a great personality. He's very curious. He's a little bit of a character, but he is doing very, very well.
Okay, so let's hear about Pauline.
Pauline is an adorable little lion cub that was born on November 5th. She was born to her mother, Felicia, who's about 2.5 years old, and her father, Ralph, who's about 4 years old. So Ralph and Felicia arrived at Santa Barbara Zoo 6 months ago, so just after the shutdown, after the first shutdown. They were introduced fairly quickly and it went super well, so it was quite a quick process. They've been very bonded ever since they were put together. Almost 6 months to the date of them arriving, little Pauline was born. Felicia is, because she's only 2.5 years old, that's fairly young for a lion to have offspring. They can certainly have offspring at that age, but from a maturity point of view, it's quite young. She's also a first-time mother as well, so she's relatively inexperienced at giving birth and then looking after offspring.
Pauline had a bit of a rough start, but how is she doing now?
So initially things were going well. Felicia was looking after her, showing all the normal maternal behaviour we would expect to see. You know, we could see the inexperience in her behaviour, but she was being a good mother from what we could tell, and the cub was nursing and appeared to be growing. So in those first few days, we didn't handle the cub at all. It was really important for Felicia to bond with her cub, so we stayed very hands-off during the first week to give them that time, because if we come and interfere with the cub and get our smells all over the cub, etc., there's a possibility that Felicia may have rejected the cub. So once we felt that they had bonded fairly well, we then, at about a week of age, went in, separated Felicia from the cub so that we could examine the cub. And the cub appeared to be doing very well at that point in time. So we didn't have any concerns and we put them back together. By about 2 weeks, though, the cub was noticeably deteriorating fairly rapidly. And there was a period where we noticed on video, because we are video monitoring them 24 hours a day, we noticed that the cub was becoming inactive. Felicia was getting a little rough with the cub, pushing the cub around, probably trying to stimulate a response from the cub. And so we knew something was wrong. So we separated Felicia off again so we could get access to the cub. And at that stage, we found that the cub had lost a lot of weight, was very dehydrated, it was really hypothermic, very low body temperature, and therefore would have been very hypoglycemic as well. So at that point, we took the cub and placed it in intensive care at our hospital. Fortunately, with all the medical care that the cub got, the cub was able to turn around and sort of get back onto the path of being a healthy cub again and continuing to grow. And so we don't know exactly what happened. It's obvious that the cub was not getting enough milk for some reason. We don't know if the problem was Felicia not having enough milk, or perhaps the cub just wasn't latching properly or something. Or perhaps there was a problem with the cub and the cub was getting a little sick and therefore wasn't nursing as much. And we really don't quite know which came first, but the end result was a cub who was in a critical stage by the time we got to her. So she came to the hospital. She was placed in an incubator for several days, IV fluids, and then we had to teach her to actually take formula from a bottle. And she caught on to that pretty fast. After about a week of being in the hospital, and the cub had definitely turned around, was gaining weight, was strong. And we were wondering, okay, is it time to see if we can reintroduce her back in with Felicia? So because she's a single cub, we really didn't want her to raise her on her own. We want her to know that she's a lion as she's growing up. And if she's being raised as a singleton by humans, we know that that can lead to behavioral problems in their adulthood, socially and psychologically. So we talked to the species survival plan for African lions and sought their opinion and some advice. We sort of came to the conclusion that because she was a single cub and she wasn't being raised with other offspring being hand-reared, that it was worth the risk of seeing whether Felicia would actually take her back. And what that involves is we actually took the cub down to the lion holding area where Felicia was and let her see the cub. So we don't just put the cub straight in with her, because obviously that's very risky because we didn't know what her response to the cub would be. So we actually showed her the cub. She showed a lot of interest in the cub, and then she started doing what we would call a cub call, a specific call to the cub, and the cub was responding back to her and she was looking very interested in the cub. So these were all really positive signs that she recognized the cub and that she wanted access to the cub. So we took a deep breath and we popped the cub in with her and then watched her behavior. And initially she seemed a little sort of agitated when the cub was first put in with her. But after about an hour or so, she started to settle down. She started grooming the cub, and then we left the cub in with her overnight because we were seeing positive signs. And everything went well that first night. And basically the cub has been back with her all that time now.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking with Dr. Julie Barnes from the Santa Barbara Zoo. How do you bottle feed a cub when it's in with its mother?
Felicia had an examination a couple of days before we put the cub back in with her, and we were able actually to check her mammary glands, and she didn't have very much milk, so she had dried up basically. So we knew that we were going to have to continue to bottle feed the cub, even though it was back in with its mum. How we do that is currently she's getting 5 bottles a day between 7 in the morning and 10 in the evening. So when it's time for her bottle, Felicia is actually called to another portion of the holding area so that we can actually go in and have access to the cub to give the cub her bottle. And Felicia has been very calm through this process. It's happened multiple times a day now for over a week. Felicia remains very calm. She separates well from the cub. She's separated for maybe around 10 minutes or so while the cub gets its bottle. And then we open the slide up and we let her go back to the cub, and she's usually very calm after that.
How much did she weigh when she was born?
We didn't get our hands on until about a week after she was born. You know, as I talked about, we wanted to give them that time to bond together. But when we examined her at 1 week of age, she was 1.78 kilograms, a bit smaller than a small house cat at that stage. She is now just over 4 weeks old, maybe 4.5 weeks old. And today she was 3.5 kilograms. So she is thriving now. She's got her little bottom teeth are through. So her lower incisors started to come through at about 3 weeks of age. So the rest of her teeth are going to gradually start to come through as well. She's doing a little bit of growling and hissing at times, which is very normal cat behavior. And we expect to see that. So it's very cute when she does that. You know, she'll do some calling to Felicia. So you'll hear the little sort of the cub cry.
A recording of her a few weeks old. Do you think that's a roar or a call to her mother?
It's really more a call to her mum. It's almost like a cry. She doesn't have that mental capacity at the moment to sort of figure that she needs to protect a territory or anything like that, which is what roars are normally associated. What's most vitally important to her for survival is just calling to her mother.
How quickly will she grow and become more independent?
So she's growing fairly rapidly, but she will need to be bottle fed probably until around 10 to 12 weeks of age at least. While she's very small and manageable, it's safe for us to go in with the cub. She's already starting to get her teeth, And of course, because she'll be growing up with her mum, she will show lion behavior, which is what we want. We want her to understand that she is a lion and we want her to behave like a lion. But she will have a bond with the humans who have been raising her, which will allow us that accessibility to her to continue to bottle feed her. As she starts to get bigger and, you know, potentially starts to become more dangerous, we'll start feeding, providing her the bottle through the mesh, and we won't actually go in with her.
And how much will she eventually weigh as a full-grown lion?
Her mother is a good-sized lion and her dad is a good-sized lion. So, you know, presumably Pauline will grow to be a good-sized lion as well. So anywhere from, you know, 140 to 170 pounds at adult weight.
And these lions are considered social cats. So does that mean that Felicia, Ralph, and Pauline will live together long-term?
Right now, Ralph is separated for the safety of the cub. So he has visual access to them, but he doesn't actually share space with them right now. You know, and it's well known that males will potentially harm their cubs, their offspring. So right now he's separated. Pauline, the cub, gets a little bit bigger and bit stronger. The mother-cub bond is really solidified. Then we will introduce Ralph to them. So first we would introduce Ralph to Felicia, the female, and then to the cub as well. And hopefully everything will go well and they will live together as a family unit as long as the cub is here with us at the zoo.
How are you managing during the pandemic?
We managed to get through the first closure. We were closed for 3 months. When we opened up, we found that we had, you know, a lot of community support, time-ticketed entry, so everything was purchased online. We had a lot of extra sanitation around the zoo in the high touch points. We mandated wearing of masks, and all those precautions were to keep our staff and our guests safe. On top of that, we also had to worry about the risk of COVID being transmitted to our animals, particularly to our mammals. The coronavirus has caused the COVID-19 disease in several big cats in zoos. There have been some lions in Barcelona Zoo. There were lions at Bronx Zoo. There were also some tigers, I think, at a zoo in Tennessee. So we do know that the big cats are susceptible to the virus. So we've had to take extra precautions with our mammals as well. So our staff are keeping their distance from the animals as much as they possibly can. They're wearing masks, gloves, coveralls when they go into those spaces with the animals. So that's just another layer of things that we have to think about. Fortunately, as far as we know, we haven't had any COVID cases in our animals. You know, our visitation was good when we were open, and we certainly were hoping that we wouldn't now find ourselves back in this situation of being closed again. Obviously, our operating costs are relatively high. We have a large number of mouths to feed. We have over 500 animals that need to be fed on a daily basis. Costs us around $6,000 a week to actually feed our animals. Of our annual budget relies on earned revenue that comes from the operations, which is, you know, people coming through the gate, sales of concessions. So while we're closed, you know, we have almost no way to generate any revenue. So given our high operating costs, that's quite challenging for us.
I saw that there's an emergency fund set up for donations that people can donate online to the zoo. Are there other ways that people can help?
There's several ways that you can support the zoo during this critical time that the zoo is actually closed down again. You can buy zoo membership as gifts for your family and friends. You can sponsor an animal through our foster feeder program. You can donate directly to our Santa Barbara Zoo Emergency Operating Fund through our retail store as well. So there's lots of different ways to support the zoo during this holiday period.
And that's all at sbzoo.org. When the zoo reopens in a few weeks, do you think that Pauline will be out and about at that time?
You know, hopefully by around 3 months of age, she'll be spending, you know, all day out in the exhibit.
Thank you very much for the update.
All right. Thanks so much, Beth.
It's Dr. Julie Barnes, Vice President of Animal Care and Health at the Santa Barbara Zoo. This is Beth Thornton.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.